From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump was busy on Twitter this morning in a series of blistering tweets. He took aim at Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller, describing Mueller as the exact opposite of a saint, calling him and his prosecutors in the FBI's Russia investigation terrible people at the Justice Department, justice in quotes, who should investigate Hillary Clinton instead of his campaign's possible collusion with Russians. He might have been responding to a remarkable turn yesterday in the FBI's Russia investigation. In a court filing, Mueller's team accused Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chair, of repeatedly lying to them, breaching a plea agreement to cooperate in the Russia investigation, and they recommended that Manafort be sentenced immediately for the foreign lobbying violations to which he pled guilty. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing is here. And Phil, how unusual is this? You know, what he sacrificed, a plea deal, less jail time, by not telling the truth?
It's not unusual in this case, because if you think about another person who's involved, the former junior campaign aide, George Papadopoulos, he tried to withdraw from the guilty plea that he concluded with the special counsel's office last year. Now, a judge didn't agree, and Papadopoulos had to report to prison on Monday as he was sentenced as part of his guilty plea. But Paul Manafort is not the first person to try and back out of an agreement that he's made with prosecutors in this case, although in his instance, it could be much more consequential for Manafort because he was facing punishment for not one but two separate federal cases, the one in Washington, D.C., and then one for which he was actually convicted by a jury in Virginia. And so Paul Manafort's looking at quite a bit of jail time if prosecutors don't go back to the judge and say, he's been cooperating with us, please go easy on him.
Yeah, well, and what does the investigation lose? Isn't this a valuable witness?
That's a great question. No one on the outside can answer it. Paul Manafort's attorneys said in their response to this filing that they don't believe he's given investigators false information. They believe that his plea agreement should continue to stand because he's been providing what they called useful information to the special counsel's office and investigators. But I think we can deduce from this turn of events that there's been a breakdown at some point along the line before now, and the government feels that it's exhausted all its opportunities to try and negotiate with Manafort or bring him around in the way that they want him to come around. And so then they're going to tell this judge, the deal's off. Please dispose of Manafort however you see fit.
And could it be that they just discovered? I mean, you say he's not saying the things that perhaps they're looking for and know that he knows. But is it possible that they just discovered that he lied?
The timing is not clear, but what has become clear from the work product of the special counsel's office is that it has sometimes granular levels of detail in terms of documents and other witness testimony about things that have taken place in this case. And so if investigators were able to establish through other witnesses or through other sources, emails or documents, for example, that something had or had not taken place, and they asked Manafort about that and he didn't give the answer that they knew to be true from those other investigations, that is the source of this dispute. We'll have to see how this goes or whether or not the breach has been so final that, in fact, Manafort will go before a judge and be sentenced once and for all. That isn't scheduled for right now, but as you said, the government said in its court filing that it wants it to happen soon if it could.
Well, there are other developments, as you mentioned, and on another front with Jerome Corsi, who rejected a plea deal with Mueller's team. But prosecutors have been investigating whether Corsi, who's a conspiracy theorist and a conservative commentator, but whether he coordinated with WikiLeaks and Trump associate Roger Stone about the release of those Russian-hacked Democratic emails before the 2016 election. What interests you about this?
Well, one aspect of the story that has not been established firmly is if there was a chain of linkages between Americans in 2016 and Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who we know from other court documents was, prosecutors say, allegedly getting stolen material from Russia's intelligence agency, who was involved and how did it work? And one person that has come up a lot in that discussion is Roger Stone, this political consultant, this advisor to Trump, who actually wasn't a formal member of his campaign. And one of the people in and Stone's camp is this Corsi who you talked about a moment ago. Who was involved? Who talked to who? How does it work? How did it work? Was there any connection at all? Corsi and Stone and other people in their camp have said there was no connection, that they were taking statements made publicly by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and puffing them up internally, making it appear to people on the Trump campaign, maybe to Trump himself potentially, that they knew things on an insider basis that they didn't actually know. But what we're still waiting for is whether there'll be an indictment or a criminal complaint or other work product from the special counsel's office that will lay out definitively all the facts in that case in the way that other facts have been laid out before.
And one of the big questions that you just laid down there is who was involved? Look, very briefly, you said Manafort is going to be going for sentencing. Might we learn in court what he lied about?
When and if that happens, we will learn a great deal because there'll be documents from his camp, a response from the government, and that could be another big milestone in this case going forward.
Phil Ewing, National Security Editor for NPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, British Prime Minister Theresa May is crisscrossing the United Kingdom trying to build support for her plan to pull the UK out of the European Union. As she tries to build support at home, though, President Trump told reporters here in the U.S. yesterday that May's Brexit deal could threaten a U.S.-UK trade agreement.
I think we have to take a look at seriously whether or not the U.K. is allowed to trade because, you know, right now, if you look at the deal, they may not be able to trade with us.
Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, has the Prime Minister responded to these comments from President Trump?
She has indeed. I have to say, she must be thinking with friends like Donald Trump, who needs enemies, to use the old phrase. But she's politely been saying that, look, yes, Britain is talking to the United States, has been and will be about trade deals and now and after it leaves the European Union. But clearly, it wasn't very helpful. And in a funny sort of way, I mean, I suspect there are all sorts of misunderstandings on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, the figures as they stand, so with Britain as a member of the European Union, just to get that out there, I mean, the United States accounts for nearly 20% of UK's exports by value, second only, of course, to the European Union at 44%. So there's massive amounts of trade going on. I mean, I suspect where the president is right is that if you think about it, there are two regulatory superpowers in the world. Don't worry, I'm going to shut up in a second. There's the United States and the European Union, and one suspects that after Britain leaves the EU, it will choose to stay close to the EU in regulatory terms, just like Canada stays close to the US.
Okay, so while the Prime Minister is dealing with these comments from President Trump, she's also dealing with comments from members of her own Conservative Party who are unleashing scathing attacks on her Brexit plan. Here is Sir Michael Fallon on the BBC today.
This is not a good deal. And if it's possible to get a better deal, to send the negotiators back to Brussels for 2 or 3 months, even to postpone the actual leaving date for 2 or 3 months, I still think that would be in the long-term interests of the country. We have to get this right.
Okay, so Parliament is supposed to vote on Prime Minister May's Brexit plan December 11th. Any update on the odds that that will pass?
I think the odds are really against Prime Minister. And you played that clip there of Michael Fallon. I was thinking what Donald Trump was saying. And I was thinking about a punk rock song when I was a kid, slightly giving my age away, by a magazine called Shot by Both Sides. And that is Theresa May. I was watching the debate in Parliament on Monday. I've never seen a Prime Minister get such a mauling. I mean, we at the BBC, we did the figures. She took questions for 2.5 hours. 122 MPs intervened in a negative way, not just in like a niggling kind of way, but having a right great big smack at her deal. Only 17 spoke in favour. So I think at this point, everyone is now sort of assuming she's going to lose the vote and that the question will be by how much and then what happens next.
And is the likelihood that somebody replaces her one of the things that will happen next? And is it likely that one of the things that will happen next is that somebody replaces her? And who would that be?
Well, that's getting a bit far, and we don't know for sure that she would lose the vote. I think it depends by if she does, by how much she loses it by. I mean, if she loses it by a lot, then I think she is in big trouble. Her plans for leaving the European Union are in big trouble. And if you think British politics is looking kind of crazy right now, wait until that happens, because I think we really would be in uncharted territories. I mean, Britain is already in a political crisis in the sense that there's no consensus among its politicians about how how and in what manner exactly Britain should leave the European Union and the future, what the future relationship should be. I mean, if the deal gets voted down, and by a long way, I mean, really, we're off the navigational chart, I think.
Despite the odds, Rob, she seems pretty confident. She seems to be doubling down on her plan. She has challenged the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, to a head-to-head debate.
She has. I mean, nobody could say that the Prime Minister wasn't dogged and determined. And, you know, that's hugely admired in this country. I mean, if you think about it, our national motto is mustn't grumble, or words to that effect. So she scores big on that front. And there is one thing going for her, just one thing, apart from her doggedness. And that is, for all the criticism of her plan, and boy, is she getting a lot. I mean, neither those who would like to a really hard Brexit from the EU, or those who really want to remain, I mean, they can't unite around a single leader or a single plan. So I don't know, maybe hers gets through by default, even though most people think it's a pretty rubbish idea.
That's the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson in London with the latest on Brexit. Rob, thank you.
Good to be with you, as always.
That was the scene inside Mission Control at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California yesterday when NASA's InSight spacecraft landed on Mars. After a six-month journey hurtling through space, the probe became the eighth spacecraft ever to land on the Red Planet, and it's already sending back photos. Joining us now is the principal investigator of the Mars InSight mission, Bruce Bannard. Bruce, welcome to Here and Now. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
How are you doing today?
I'm still walking on air today.
I bet. Well, this is just amazing, traveling more than 100 million miles to reach Mars, and it landed safely. How nervous were you yesterday?
I was pretty nervous. I thought as I was coming up this week that I was handling it pretty well, but by a few minutes before landing, I was pretty much a basket case.
How do you make sure that it lands upright?
Well, I mean, we land on rockets, and so there's software on board that controls the rockets and keeps the balance such that it's upright. Of course, what we have to make sure is that you don't land on a surface that has a big rock under one leg that might flip you over. And so we spent a lot of time picking out a region on Mars. We found a region that was pretty big that didn't have very many rocks, maybe, you know, a tenth of a percent of the area had big rocks on it. And so statistically, we were in pretty good shape. But, you know, you can always have a bad day when you're working with statistics. So we were still pretty nervous.
And I assume you can't control it as it's happening because there's probably a delay from what you're doing to what actually is going on.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, the light time delay, the time it takes for a radio signal to get from the Earth to Mars or from Mars to the Earth is about 8 seconds right now. No, I'm sorry, 8 minutes. And so since it only takes 6.5 minutes to go from the top of the atmosphere to the surface, it's actually already landed by the time we start getting telemetry back that it's starting the process. So it has to do everything autonomously. All the software on board is already set up to go through the sequence of events that it needs to go through to get to the surface.
Now, if it had fallen on its side, or if it does now, let's say there's a windstorm and it gets knocked over, is there a way for you to get the InSight back upright?
No, there's not. I mean, this is not a rover mission. It's mm-hmm. not a spacecraft that's built to move itself around on the ground. It's built to be a stationary scientific station as soon as it touches down. And so basically, wherever we stick it, that's where we're going to stay.
And what is it that you are trying to find out from this InSight?
Well, InSight's the first mission to go to Mars to try to probe deep into the planet and understand the structure of the interior of the planet, the size of the core, the thickness of the crust, the composition of the inside. All the other missions that have gone before have looked at things like the geology, the chemistry of the surface, the characteristics of the atmosphere, and we know a lot about Mars' surface now, but we know very, very little about the deep inside of Mars. And this is actually really critical to understanding the history of the planet and the reasons why the surface looks the way it does today.
Why is that? What does it tell you when you know what's underneath the surface?
Well, Mars is kind of a unique laboratory for us, a planetary laboratory, in that it's gone through all the very initial processes of planetary formation back 4.5 billion years ago. But then just a few tens of millions of years after it formed, it slowed way down. And so the structures that were set up way back then are still in place. The crust that was put in place when it was first formed, the structure of the mantle and so forth. And so we can actually use Mars as kind of a time machine to go back and look at, you know, how things were on the planets very soon after they were first formed. And there's some very key processes that determine which way a planet's going to go, you know, whether it goes to a planet with a thick atmosphere and an ocean, or it goes to a very dry planet with a thin atmosphere, or a planet with a super thick atmosphere like Venus, which is extremely hot and sulfurous. And so these differences but among the planets, we think, are due to very subtle changes, very subtle differences in the way they formed early on. And we want to be able to understand those processes. And Mars is a great place to go and start to study that.
You're also going to be monitoring for Mars quakes. I didn't even think of the word earthquake having to do with Earth, because we just say it like it's just another word in our language. But it wouldn't be an earthquake on Mars. It would be a Mars quake.
Absolutely. I mean, why not?
Right. So what are you going to learn from that?
Well, the thing about Mars quakes is that they send waves through the planet, vibrational waves, or so-called seismic waves. And as those waves pass through the planet, they get affected by the materials that they travel through. And so when we sense them at the surface after they've gone down into the planet and come back up to the surface on the other side, we can actually take those wiggles that you see on the seismograms from earthquakes on the Earth, and we can analyze the shapes of those wiggles, their frequencies, the timing of when they arrive, and put together an actual 3D view of the material that it passed through. And so by accumulating the information from a lot of Mars quakes, we can actually get a 3D map of the inside of the planet. And so I like to think of a quake being like a flashbulb that goes off and it illuminates the inside of the planet, and the seismometers are our eyes that allow us to start to see the structure deep inside a planet.
You started this project more than a decade ago. How much has the mission changed since that? I imagine that technology has changed pretty dramatically since then, but how much has the mission changed?
The mission has not changed very much since we conceived it about 9 or 10 years ago. We've had several iterations of trying to figure out how to send seismometers to Mars. And this latest one that we're actually operating right now on the surface, and that I still get a quiver in my stomach every time I say that. Mm-hmm. The mission that we conceived about 9 or 10 years ago is very close to the one that we're flying today. And it's some of the details have changed. The way we've actually, you know, implemented the connection of the seismometer to the spacecraft and some of the shielding techniques and things like that. But the mission itself has been pretty constant.
How far away is InSight from some of the other spacecraft that are on Mars or around Mars at the moment?
It's actually very close to Curiosity, and by very close, I mean about 200 or 300 miles away. Mm-hmm. We're just about due north of Curiosity, which actually makes a little bit of a traffic jam on Mars, in the sense that the data that we bring back from the surface of Mars is relayed through basically telecommunication orbiters. And so when an orbiter goes overhead, we beam our information up to the orbiter, and the orbiter has a stronger radio that can then beam it back to Earth. And those spacecraft generally go in a north-south orbit. So when an orbiter is going over InSight, it's also going over Curiosity on the same orbit. And so we have to put together sort of a sharing process that mm-hmm. Sometimes, Curiosity gets the orbiter, sometimes we get the orbiter, and we have to share the data stream coming back.
Why is it so important that we study Mars?
Well, I think it's important to study Mars, not just for its own sake. I mean, it's an exciting place. It's a different place, and in terms of you know, exploring, you know, new places and new things, it's a very tempting target. But it also, as I was saying before, it tells us a lot about how planets form, and then we can apply that back to our own planet. Understand, you know, why we have a planet, that has oceans, why we have a planet that has a breathable atmosphere and a temperature which is conducive to life. I mean, it's not a foregone conclusion that you can get a planet that way. And I think it's important to understand, you know, how Earth got to be the way it is, and to understand, you know, how stable is the environment that we're living in, and how are we likely to be able to affect it in the future.
So when are we going to have a person, do you think, on Mars?
I believe, and this is, you know, just purely speculation, but just, you know, my gut feeling is, I think, you know, maybe in 20 years, 25 mm-hmm. years, we could have people walking on Mars. Wow. You know, if we decide that that's something that's important and something that we want to do. I know the technology exists, and I think we could do it. But 25 years maybe. I hope to be around to see that.
So yesterday when this happened, when the landing happened successfully, I tweeted out, we can land a spacecraft on Mars, but we still can't figure out how to blank. And people were responding, you know, grow romaine lettuce, move traffic efficiently. What would your answer to that be? What is the thing after you've just done this that you are still like, how can we not figure out this other thing?
Oh boy, I always smile when I see that, because, you know, I said, yeah, we can land a spacecraft on Mars, and I think about, you know, the 10 years that I've spent, you know, helping to design and implement this project, and all the problems and all the issues that you know, we ran into, and all the expertise and the different people from all kinds of different backgrounds that we brought to help us, you know, figure out and fix all the issues. And I'm thinking, yeah, we can land a mission on Mars, but it's not as easy as it looks. You know?
It takes a long time.
It does.
That is Bruce Bannert, who is the principal investigator on the Mars InSight mission. Thank you so much, and congratulations again. We can't wait to see what InSight sends back.
Neither can I. And it's great talking to you.
We've got a photo from Mars sent back by InSight at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A new study commissioned by Koch Industries suggests that President Trump's tariffs could cost American families $2,400 next year in the form of higher prices, lower wages, lost jobs, lower returns on investments. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
And, you know, this week we heard about GM idling 5 plants, saying the tariffs cost them $1 billion. Before that, the company said tariffs could lead to job losses. Are these plant closings the kind of thing this new study is talking about?
Well, sort of. General Motors has had problems for a long time, and that's a leadership problem at GM. Mm-hmm. There's probably something to do with trade and tariffs that are involved in this. But this study is a lot broader, and it talks about the kinds of things that will cost people money or stop them from making money if these tariffs, if this trade war stays in place?
Well, now consumers have been, you know, mostly insulated from these new tariff costs. So let's take a look. The study says each household could pay $2,400 more or $915 per person. How do they, what do they mean? How do they arrive at that?
Well, there are a few things that they are looking at. They're looking at the cumulative impact of tariffs. So the added cost of things that you buy, because we buy a lot of imported stuff, the added cost of things that you buy that is not imported, but it costs more to make in the United States, lower wages because of jobs that will be lost as a result of the tariffs, and a lower return on investment. You can see how the trade war has affected the stock market. So that they've calculated all of those costs and say that you're going to end up with the household, the average household will end up with $2,400 more in the short term.
But then they lose, right?
Yes.
So look, this was commissioned by Koch Industries, as we said. This is the Koch family's private company, the largest in the U.S. after Cargill. Annual revenue of $115 billion, very much anti the Trump tariffs. So, you know, what do you say to someone who says it's skewed because the Kochs have a stake in this?
Yes, so that's a good question. By the way, when I meant 2,400 less, so you're correct.
Right, right.
People are going to pay, but as it goes further out, they say that houses will lose much more. Look, you got to take it with a pinch of salt. It's a study. It's a projection. The Koch brothers do not like higher taxes, and they do not like tariffs. A lot of people who don't like higher taxes equate tariffs with those. The Kochs are major industrialists, so this hurts them. That said, they show you the long homework. These things all get taken with a pinch of salt, but there's no question that there will be added costs to goods if we're trading less. Wages are higher in the United States. If we're buying things that are made here as opposed to made in China or the Philippines or Vietnam, it's going to be more expensive. The other side of the equation is a little harder to tell. Will we have lower wages as a result? The president thinks the opposite. And will we have lower returns in the stock market as a result? I could argue that the stock market might be slowing down just because it's been expanding for 10 years. So half of it I can justify, and the other half we'd have to wait and see.
Yeah, but we don't want you to. We want you to guess right now. So they say 2,400. Just your best guess, what it might be.
Well, what's happening is in the initial period, we're seeing a lot of companies try and hold off increases on costs. That will change over time. So it may feel like less than that in the first year. It's going to feel like a lot more than that as long as tariffs stay in place.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
Democrats are now on track to pick up 40 seats in the House of Representatives if they can win the 21st District in California, where the Democrat has pulled into the lead. 40 seats would be a very big blue wave. One of the new members of Congress will be one of the first Muslim women ever elected, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. The other is Minnesota's Ilhan Omar. Tlaib is a Democratic socialist, and she's on the line. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I wanted to start with a big story in the news right now, the migrants that we've seen rushing the southern border over the weekend at the crossing between Tijuana and San Diego. American authorities say that several Border Patrol agents were hit by rocks, which prompted them to use tear gas. What do you think of how that situation was handled, or how do you think that that situation should have been handled?
Oh, obviously, it shouldn't have been handled that way. I think, you know, some of the visuals I've seen has been clearly just the inhumanity of how we're addressing people that are seeking some sort of safe haven. And, you know, our country has always been, you know, when you thought about immigration in many ways, for years, it was always about family unification, about safe haven, about freedom and all of those things that I think we constantly hear from heads of our country that's why we go to war is to, you know, continue supporting democracy and freedom and all these things. But then we go ahead and tear gas children and cage them up and separate them from families.
Well, should the U.S. grant asylum to all of those people who are seeking asylum at the border there in Tijuana and other places as well?
They deserve a chance to apply. And, you know, there's a process in place. I was an immigration attorney for almost 2.5 years. I remember the process that you go through. It's a rigorous process, but everyone had an equal access to that process if they did it right. And then by them coming to the border and claiming it, I mean, they have every right to claim asylum. And all I'm asking is that we go back to fairness and the rule of law. We can't just sit there and allow our president to act above the law. It, to me, it's dictatorship. It cannot allow him to take it this far.
Well, what about people, though, who disagree with you and say if you want to follow the rule of law, then that means that people cannot cross into the border illegally? I'm not talking necessarily even just about asylum seekers, but people that are coming over the border without going through the official process. Is that something that you are worried about as well?
Well, I can tell you, our country has been one of those countries where corporations used to go. Henry Ford used to go to the border and say, come on in, even though our country is like, don't come in. If you really want to fix our immigration system and really try to say, okay, we got to stop this kind of so-called jumping over the border, then go after the businesses and the corporations that benefit the most from the broken immigration system. Because many of my immigrant neighbors would not come to this country but for somebody offering them a job. And so let's look at that view versus always going after the weak, that individual that would die to come to this country. You will never, ever be able to stop all of it unless we really look at the fact that who benefits the most from it.
You are a Palestinian American, and you have called for a one-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. What does that mean? How would that work? And do you think it's realistic, given obviously President Trump in the White House has a very different view?
Well, I can tell you, you know, I grew up in probably the most beautiful, blackest city in the country, the city of Detroit. And many of my teachers were teachers that showed me like neighborhoods they couldn't live in because of the color of their skin, or showing me where their loved ones were, you know, beaten by authorities and police because of the color of their skin and because they couldn't work in certain places. There was separate lines. And so, you know, this whole idea around two-state, of course, if it's determined by the people on the ground, I would support it. But I know separate but equal didn't work for us, and I can't see it working in any other country.
But I imagine the Israelis would say, well, we can't do that. We can't have everybody be together because there'd be just an enormous amount of violence.
Yeah, and that's what they said about black people moving into neighborhoods that were predominantly white. And, you know, when I wrote a paper about this issue, I put integrating schools. I think having Palestinian Israeli children go to school together, having them get raised together, you know, I would love to see intermarriages. I would love to see, you know, this sense that happens, because right now they actually, you know, the dehumanization that happens on both sides, that is what's feeding into the violence, and that's what's feeding into the division that happens. And, you know, it will never end until we start seeing each other as equals.
I just want to finally ask you some questions as you prepare to go to Washington. First of all, do you plan to support Nancy Pelosi to be the Speaker of the House?
Well, I could tell you, you know, this is the first time in 50 years since we've had new representation in my district. And, you know, I have the third poorest congressional district in the country. And it is really important to me to make sure that we talk about the P word, which is poverty. And we talk about working class families. When we talk about middle class families, I can tell you it leaves so many of my residents out. When I talk about the fact that there's continuation with discrimination among the banking industry, I mean, less than half of my families own their own home in the Wayne County area. All of these are these barriers that I need, you know, there'd be political courage and might to fight back. I can tell you, I have met with Leader Pelosi. There is sincerity there of wanting to address these issues. I want the conversation around these issues in my district to be at the forefront of me deciding who's going to lead our caucus. And so I want to continue that dialogue in the next 2 weeks and hopefully be able to get our caucus moving towards that direction. And I believe that happens with the continued dialogue that I'm having now with Leader Pelosi.
So that sounds like a probably yes for Pelosi.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think the American people need to understand there is no one else running against her in the Democratic caucus. And we can continue saying if we're going to support or not. I'm not sure what the strategy here is. I can tell you that my conversations have always been around the issues. And people are still taken aback by the fact that I have the third poorest congressional district. And I want this opportunity, when we talk about leadership, to talk about those issues, because that is the only time that I feel like people are going to hear me mm-hmm. in a way that will make a difference and make my families feel like they have a voice at the table.
What scares you most as you prepare to enter Congress?
You know, I want to be able to transform people's lives, and it's such a short period of time for us to hit the ground running. So my biggest fear is the time, right? These are years that I can't get back for my residents, and I need to be able to hit the ground running, get things done quickly as possible. And that's why creating neighborhood service centers in my district, you know, I keep telling my residents, I don't want you to have to wait for me to pass Medicare for All to get quality health care. Call my service centers that I'm going to create. You know, I ran because I work extremely hard, and I didn't want to be on the outside ring, and I wanted to be on the inside to make those changes. I want it to be done quickly and effectively, and done in a way that is, to me, brings in a lot of new voices that have been elected to Congress at the table. And I really think just alone clearing out the room and just putting the moms, Republican and Democratic moms, in a room, probably in a few hours, we'd probably fix the gun crisis, because we're so much more focused as mothers, not as Democrats or Republicans. I want us to move quickly.
Anything that you will work together with President Trump on?
Look, it's really hard to work with someone that doesn't understand the rule of law, taking his powers beyond what is permitted. You know, I'm a lawyer, so obstruction of justice is huge for me. And so it's really difficult to be someone that's going to say, I'm going to work with President Trump when, you know, the integrity is not there, right? The trust level is not there. And so I will do everything in my power to make sure my families feel like they have a seat at the table. But it will be very hard when, you know, the president is speaking about poor people and Muslims and others in a way that he does. It really takes the kind of ability to be able to work across the aisle away. And I think we're, you know, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are starting to see that. But look, working with someone that thinks they're above the law, that goes around these rules and laws that I learned are really essential to keeping order and to keeping basically fairness and justice within our process, it's really difficult. And so I can tell you what I can work with him on is getting him to follow the law. And I can do that as a member of Congress. And he should expect that from me, because that's how we balance government.
That is Rashida Tlaib, who is a Democrat who will represent Michigan's 13th congressional district in the next Congress. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on your victory.
Thank you.
And it wasn't long ago that advanced skin cancer was a death sentence with survival rates of less than a year. But in the 1990s, scientists began working on something no one thought possible, harnessing the body's own immune system to fight cancer. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED met up with a young woman beating the odds thanks to these advances in science.
In the oncology unit at a UCSF Medical Center in San Francisco, a nurse wraps a blood pressure cuff tightly around Ashley Walton's thin, pale arm. She looks pretty young for 34 years.
I'll take your temperature right under your tongue. Is that okay?
Sure. The nurse leads her and her mother down a hall to meet Ashley's oncologist for a quarterly check-in.
Hey. Hello.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Ashley warmly embraces Dr. Adil Dowd.
So how are you?
I'm good. I'm married now. I'm a
congratulations.
married old woman.
Nice.
For many years, Ashley doubted marriage was in her future. When she was 26, she found a mole on the back of her hip.
And it started morphing into this ugly, dark, bleeding thing that just, I knew something was wrong.
Doctors surgically removed it. Then a couple of years later, a tiny lump popped up in Ashley's abdomen.
And over the next few weeks, it started growing and growing until it was about the size of a walnut.
A biopsy revealed she had stage 4 melanoma. In total shock, she scoured the internet and found the average survival rate was 6 to 9 months.
I saw that and I freaked out.
But her oncologist told her to ignore the numbers.
Dr. Dowd told me, if there's any time to have melanoma, right now is a pretty good time to have it because there's a lot of stuff opening up to you.
Well, the major excitement in our field is on, you know, using immune checkpoint blockers. And the idea here is that if you have T cells turned off by what's known as the PD-1, PDL-1 checkpoint.
Okay, let me try to simplify this. Normally, when the body sees toxic material, immune cells kill it. But cancer cells are really sneaky. They put the brakes on the immune system. Immune checkpoint blockers stop that from happening.
You're basically preventing that break from engaging.
Would it be kind of similar, like cancer kind of has like this invisible cloak that it like kind of hides under, and then you kind of take off that cloak?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe it.
Since the cancer is no longer invisible, the immune system can mount an attack. It was a huge breakthrough when the Food and Drug Administration approved the first drugs to do this in 2011. The science behind the miracle drug was developed back in the 90s by a guy named Max Crummell in a lab at UC Berkeley.
I was a very frustrated graduate student for a few years trying to develop an antibody that would do something.
After many long nights, Crummell noticed his antibody was influencing the behavior of immune cells.
You can drive them like a car. You can accelerate them or you can brake them. And then it was really like playtime.
He started injecting the antibodies into sick mice.
And essentially, in the very first set of experiments, my antibodies caused tumors to shrink.
Now, fast forward a couple of decades to Ashley Walton's story. Her doctors hope the technology developed in Crummell's lab could be the key to killing her cancer. But the treatment was harrowing. When Ashley started receiving immunotherapy, the 90-minute drips were followed by a slew of side effects.
I started getting really high fevers. I got a few skin rashes, gastritis.
Still, her tumors were shrinking. Then, after 6 months, new lesions cropped up in Ashley's abdomen. So her doctors added a second immunotherapy drug to the mix. Unfortunately, she had a lot of the drug's possible side effects.
Yeah, I just generally felt like the life was being sucked out of me. So it's you go into a really dark place.
For several years, Ashley hitchhiked from drug to drug just to stay alive.
There are so many advancements being made in the field of immunotherapy that even if it doesn't cure you, it gets you to the next big thing.
That wild ride paid off. She hasn't had an infusion in the last 10 months.
So am I technically in remission?
Yes, wow. You're technically in remission. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
Stories like Ashley's are really exciting to oncologists. Dr. Leonard Lichtenfeld is the chief medical officer for the American Cancer Society.
So imagine when we've gone from a time when we had nothing to offer to today, and they're talking about cure for some patients with advanced melanoma.
Scientists and big pharma are really hopeful about the future. There's about 1,000 current trials to develop new immunotherapy drugs to help more people fight different kinds of cancer. About 30 to 40% of patients still do not respond to immunotherapy.
Remember, we're at the beginning of this journey. We're not at the end. We still have a long way to go. We're going to have ups and we're going to have downs.
Back in the exam room, Ashley and her mom received surprising news at her latest checkup with Dr. Dowd.
So what do you think about pregnancy or trying to start a family?
So I think this is a good time to get pregnant, actually.
Ashley crosses her fingers and smiles. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Good news. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.